Hello, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you, what is it that we bring you? Well, that's the very beginning of what we're talking about. We bring you ideas, concepts, and things to help you lead a more positively minded life. But one of the things that we bring you is information. And today I want to talk about memory. Memory and some of the thoughts about memory, about what's true and what's not true. Is it true you lose your memory when you get older? Is it true you lose your memory when you get depressed? Is it true that if things are emotionally laden, you can have a greater memory of it? Or is it if it has a negative emotion, you have a lesser memory of it? Is there such a thing as repressed memories from childhood? All of this I want to talk about in the studio and in the with us on the program today is Pierce Howard. Pierce Howard, author of The Owner's Manual for the Brain, as you know, a Bible here at our radio station. Pierce is on the phone with us. Pierce, how are you?
A pleasure to be with you today.
So nice to have you back here. Pierce, I was looking through what you did with the learning. I've got a lot of my own research, but let's talk about memory. Let's talk about memory. Let's talk about what it is, how it works. Go ahead, you start.
Well, I think, you know, there's so many ways that we can approach this topic, and I think it might be helpful to start with a couple of misconceptions, if we might. First, there's an amusing idea that when we're in school, when we're in high school, when we're in college, when we're in graduate school, what do when we want to remember? We study. We underline. We make flashcards. We call things out to each other. We do a variety of things to help establish particular names, dates, facts, ideas into long-term memory.
Well, if you're going to take a test, you write it on the back of your hand so you can remember.
Well, in fact, I had a friend in college who ended up being Phi Beta Kappa, and after every lecture, he would go back to his room and create an outline of the lecture and type it up. Now, that is an activity, that's a behavior that clearly has the intention of remembering material. Now, what happens when we leave school and join the workforce, Armand, is that we stop doing those things. We'll read the newspaper in the morning, and we'll read about the president of Hewlett-Packard, and we are having coffee with a colleague at work later in the day, and we try to remember the name of the president when we're having coffee, and we can't remember it, and we say to our associate, "Oh my goodness, I'm already becoming demented. I'm losing my memory. I'm growing old. I'm getting Alzheimer's," and that's just absolutely silly. And the reason that we're feeling as though our memory is getting worse, even in our 20s and 30s, thinking that we're aging, is because we have stopped doing those behaviors that we used to do in order to remember things. It's as though we think when we graduate that our mind turns to flypaper and that it just catches all these things that we want to remember, and it doesn't. It's the same mind that we had when we were in school, and so we need to engage in those same behaviors in order to remember that we used when we were in school.
So are you saying that the aging brain and the memory of the senior moment is an illusion?
For the most part, yes. In fact, most of what we think is aging's effect on the brain is not age at all. It's things like the prolonged use of certain medications. It's prolonged inactivity without getting exercise. It's prolonged stress. In other words, if you age gracefully, and you deal with stress, and you exercise, and you eat well, you get plenty of sleep, you try to avoid prescription medications where all possible, etc., etc., etc. There should be no reason for a person's memory to be any worse at age 80 than at age 18. It's these other things that tend to assault memory. It's not age per se.
Well, what you're saying is validated by a lot of the other studies I've been reading. That they've the National Institute on the Aging first did a test to try to see if it were true about older people. And basically they're saying that the senior moment is a self-fulfilling prophecy. Once
yes.
you believe that you've lost your memory, you stop trying to remember things.
Yes, you sort of give up. You
just kind of give up. You say, what was the name of that? Oh, I don't remember. You know what I mean. Whereas when you're younger, you'll fetch for it. But it is a remarkable moment, you know, and it does happen more. I don't care what anyone says. It happens more to people as they get older. There's that thing when you're trying to remember something. Unlike when you were younger, it would pop up faster.
Okay, let's talk about why. Now, there are many ways in which the computer is a good analogy for the brain. There are some ways in which it's not, but one way in which it is an interesting analogy is, you know, what happens when your hard disk fills up? It gets slower, right? Well, the same thing happens in the brain as when we were 10 years old, we probably had maybe 5 associations with the word Armand, right? Maybe 3 or 4 or 5 associations with the word Armand, at the most, when we were 10 years old. Now, at age 60 or 70 or 80, how many associations do we have with the word Armand? Well, there are going to be hundreds, if not thousands, of associations. Poets and writers and foreign words and all kinds of things. And so when we try to remember the name of this radio talk show host in New York, and we say, oh, my gosh, I can't remember it. I'm losing my memory. One of the reasons is that the word itself has too many associations, and it's hard for it to rise to the top. And the way I suggest that people treat this so-called senior moment, and it's not really a senior moment, it's the impact of what do you want to call it? it's a very high inventory of a memory. It's
an abundance.
It's an abundance. Okay. So what I recommend to people is that they silently say to the alphabet to themselves.
Well, that really works, doesn't it?
And it really does.
It's amazing how it works. Everybody I know uses the trick. You know, start with the letter A and find out exactly what happened. Try to remember the name.
And you know how that works. You know why it works. What it does, Armand, is it excites the sound of the right word. So when I say A and then I say R, it triggers. My mind knows that I'm trying to remember the word Armand. And after I've gone through the alphabet silently and I've said A and eventually R, it excites the beginning of that word, and all of a sudden I say, Armand. That's it, Armand. And it's almost like priming the pump so that you excite the beginning sound of the word. And if you have in your mind that you're thinking talk show host, it will pop that right word right back to you.
This is Armand DeMille with Dr. Pierce Howard, author of The Owner's Manual to the Brain, which we recommend to most people. We're talking about memory. You know, when I was younger, the first work I did in psychology was at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, where I worked on memory storage with a man named, what was his name? Oh, Sam Berendes. Sam Berendes and Hirsch Cohen. Sam Berendes, who recently wrote a book and came in our studio. But Sam Berendes, anyway, what they were doing was trying to test the chemical nature of memory storage and how it works. And they would find that there were certain substances that inhibited memory by inhibiting the synthesis of the protein at the synapse. Yes. It was so complicated, but it was amazingly simple. Alcohol would do it. Acetoxycyclohexamide, which is what we worked with, did it. A number of other things did it, and it just proved that memory was kind of tenuous, that being able to form a memory of something is tenuous. Now, let's talk about people with emotionally laden memories. Who is ever going to forget 9/11? Who's going to forget the memory of 9/11? You are flooded with it. The images are in your mind. There's a tremendous emotional attachment to it. It's a thing that's in your mind is a solid, I remember it well memory. I remember other things that are very powerful memories in my life because of the emotional attachment to it.
Yeah, they call it the C, the significant emotional event. And, I mean, I remember where I was when President Kennedy was assassinated.
Most people remember that.
I remember where I was when Nelson Mandela left prison. I remember where I was when Martin Luther King was assassinated. So these are called C's. And the reason that we remember these events with such acuity is that memory formation is dependent upon many things. One of the things that is dependent upon is the production of adrenaline or epinephrine. And it's like adrenaline serves like a, if you've ever worked in a photographic darkroom, which is going to be extinct with the popularity of the digital camera, but in the old photographic darkrooms, you put a fixer in a tray, and then you put your negative in the, or your paper in the fixer, and the fixer stopped the development of the image, and it fixed it in time, and it made it nice and with good contrast and all that. Well, that's what adrenaline does with new memories. When you wash yourself with adrenaline, it tends to fix the memory. And one of the ways to have that rush of adrenaline is by having a significant emotional episode while you're experiencing the event. And it's that wash of adrenaline that happens to just cause that memory to stick. There are other ways you can get the same thing. I recommend to people after they've been studying hard to go do some jumping jacks or go for a 10-minute brisk walk and get the adrenaline pumping a little bit.
Well, you know, it's a little more than that. It's interesting that you say that. I don't know if you've run across proactive inhibition and retroactive inhibition in your studies, Pierce.
Certainly.
You know, you want to talk about that as far as memory goes?
You go right ahead.
All right. Well, as I understand it, and I may have the two confused, one of the things we used to do in trying to teach people to remember things is we'd have them do something that was different than whatever they were doing. So if you're studying math, the recommendation is don't follow studying algebra with geometry, because proactive inhibition means that whatever you study second in some way inhibits the memory of the first.
Yeah, another way of saying that in layman's language is new learning drives out old.
But it's not all new learning.
It's not all new learning.
If the new learning is significantly different, if you have mathematics and then you study music, or then you study history, there is a way of driving the earlier memory deeper. That's what the test was showing.
There's some new studies that have come out of Johns Hopkins that suggests that if the learning is novel, if it's completely new and unrelated, in other words, it's not an elaboration of something that you already knew, it's a brand new skill. Let's say it's conjugating Greek verbs, and it's a complete new concept to you. The studies that they did showed that if you attempt to learn something else completely new over the next 6 hours, that new learning will drive out the old learning. Your memory for the Greek conjugation will be less effective if you try to learn something else that's also completely new for you during the next 6 hours. And what they found in their studies is that you're better off introducing, for example, during a normal school day, you would be better off introducing completely new material first thing in the day and last thing in the day. And during the rest of the day, in the best of all possible worlds, what you would be doing is practice and elaboration of what has been learned recently and in the past.
Conjugating Mandarin. Very nice idea. You know, here's a, all right, Pierce, if you know so much, then how come men don't remember anniversaries and women do? There is a reason.
What's your reason?
The reason I think is that for women, I think most people with more serotonin tend to form bonds more easily than people with less serotonin do. So I think men, you know, are more testosteronic and they're not running on the same place. So women have this need to have a bond. And in the female system, of course, the bond is because you're going to give birth to a child and that's the way you're built. So you bond with things that represent family. You bond with things. And if anything represents family and connectedness, you bond with it and you remember it because it has an emotional impact. Valentine's Day, birthday, the first day we kissed, the first day we held hands, the first day, you know. And for men, which is quite the opposite, they don't have those hormones that are leading them to that kind of bonding. They're doing a different kind of bonding. Well, so I think for that reason, men tend not to remember as much and have a reminder.
I would suggest that what you're describing is really more of an individual difference variable. There are clearly men who not only don't remember anniversaries, but there are men who don't give a flip about anniversaries. But there are lots of other men for whom anniversaries are extremely important and make a big deal out of them. In fact, I'm one. I do make a big deal. Cook special meals. I get cards. They're flowers. And I would suggest that we may be thinking here of an individual difference variable, that it may be that there's a slight tendency for men to have a higher degree of forgetfulness about anniversaries. But some of that forgetfulness is also associated with the degree of importance they put to it. The more importance they place on it, the more likely they're going to remember it. So forgetting and valuing are two closely related things.
Well, maybe not individual difference, just maybe the difference between the mushy guys and the not so mushy guys.
Okay. Well,
and I will feel the beauty of the exquisiteness that, you know, well, we feel things.
Yeah.
And you like to feel things. And some men don't like to feel things because they're not used to feeling things.
Well, you know, one of the problems is in the female brain, the nerve fibers that connect the left and the right hemispheres, the left hemisphere, which tends to be the center of language, and the right hemisphere, the center of emotional life. The fibers that connect the two, the corpus callosum, is larger in the typical female brain than in the typical male brain. And when I say typical, we're talking about averages here. There are clearly some men that have thicker corpus callosums than others.
That's a soft spot in the brain that you'd feel in a baby. You know, you can almost put your finger through it when you feel it on a baby's skull.
No, this is deep inside the center of the brain. It's connective tissue between it. It actually kind of holds the two hemispheres together. In fact, it's been severed in the cases of some individuals who have had severe problems with seizures as a way of stopping the seizures. That's a rather drastic treatment, but. Basically, what the importance of the size of the corpus callosum is that it's like, you know, bandwidth with a computer. The greater your bandwidth, the faster the speed of communication. It's also like number of lanes in a highway. It's like women have, the typical female has more lanes in her highway that communicate from one hemisphere to the other than the typical male does. Therefore, it tends to be less natural for many men to access their feelings with language. They may have the feelings and not know what to do with them language-wise. With a typical female, it is just simply more natural to connect language and feelings because she's got more bandwidth to do it. And that's why men tend to get so, many men tend to get uptight when she says, honey, we need to talk. And
yep.
All of a sudden we're playing to his weakness.
And she says, you know, he says, why are you so sensitive? And she says, listen, fella, if only you had my corpus callosum, you'd know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, you need to build an extra lane in that highway.
Build another lane in that highway. Yeah. I like that. That could be the name of my new country western song. You know, about how you become more sensitive. Build another lane in that highway, and I'll come knocking at your door.
I would talk to you, honey, but my lane's under construction.
The owner's manual of the brain, Pierce Howard. We're talking about memory. Okay, let's talk about memory and the different kinds of memory.
Let's back up a little bit.
Sure.
and relate.
We have to be careful because I have so much fun every time I have you on the radio. I love exploring with you. You know,
feelings mutual.
We have a nice tangent. Yeah. Relationship.
Well,
okay, let's talk about the different kinds of memory.
And what I want to do is I want to relate the process of memory to what we were talking about earlier, the remembering or forgetting anniversaries. The process of memory is it employs three different aspects. And if you engage in all three of these aspects, you increase the likelihood that you remember. If you don't use these three aspects, the probability is that you will not remember. The three are intending, organizing, and practicing. So let's say that you're at a cocktail party and someone introduces themselves to you. And do you remember their name? Well, the first thing you need to do is to say to yourself, I want to remember that person's name. In other words, you've got to consciously and intentionally decide, I want to remember that. Second, you need to organize it in some way. So if I have not seen a picture of you, but let's say I'm meeting you at a party and I determine that there is a slight almond shape to your head, I may say Almond Armand and associate the name Armand to almond. And then when I think of you, I see the almond. When you do these kinds of visual associations, they are very easy to recall.
Are you saying I'm a nut?
Well,
actually, it's one of the things that people did remember. When I was a kid, they used to call me Almond Joy.
Almond Joy.
Well, you know, and
because of your exuberant emotion.
Right, it all went together, and, you know, it's fine. It fit with my name because it was a hard name to remember.
Well,
but I see you're saying, so there's
an association. The Joy part ties into DeMille because you've got Cecil B. DeMille and the Three-Ring Circus.
And the whole thing, it
the
all
the spirit
fits.
Of joy there. So there are all kinds of visual things that we could conjure up. So the second thing is to organize it in some way.
Now, wait a minute. How do people remember Pierce? You know, that's a lot of different associations that a person would make up in their mind. They would see you as a pointy person.
Well, they always get my names mixed up, so I tell them to remember that it rhymes with the fierce coward.
Yeah, you're so cute. Fierce.
They remember it. Then they've got it. They've
fierce,
got
something, Pierce.
Something concrete that they can tie it onto, and they remember it. Okay, it's not Mr. Pierce, it's Mr. Howard.
Yeah.
And they can get the order then. So we need to intend to remember. We need to organize it in some way. There are lots of simple ways to organize things like that. When I'm one of my favorite ones was a student I once had in class with bright red hair. His name was Scott Campbell, and I associated the redness of his hair to the Campbell soup can. And so every time I saw him, I saw that red hair and immediately saw Campbell soup can. I said, Mr. Campbell, how you doing? and I had his name. So if we associate it with something, then the third thing that we need to do is to practice it. And you've always heard that if you'll say somebody's name three times, you've probably got it. But you have to say it three times in order to get it. So if you intend and you organize and you practice, then the probability is that you will remember. Now, it takes about 8 seconds, according to the research. You were talking about types of memory. We've got immediate memory, short-term memory, and long-term memory. And the immediate memory is when I tell you a piece of information like 9384, you can remember those four digits for about 2 seconds without practicing. But if you didn't start saying those digits to yourself, you've probably forgotten by now what they were. If you keep saying it to yourself for about 8 seconds, you can translate it from immediate memory to short-term memory, and you'll have 9384 in short-term memory. Now, what converts it from short-term memory to long-term memory is what I was just talking about. It's doing the intending to remember, organizing it in some way, and then practicing.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. I meet thousands of people because of I'm out there in the world, and I meet so many people and speak to so many people. When I meet somebody after not having seen them for a while, I ask, "What's your name? I forgot." Now, I'm not embarrassed by that because I actually do forget people's name if I meet them one time, and there are many of them.
Sure.
And so if I meet them a second time and a third time, I'll probably remember their name. But there's something embarrassing about saying to someone that you've met that I forgot your name, and people don't do it. So they have this kind of fake, you know, they have this thing with a kind of trying to figure out what your name may be. I wonder what it is that embarrasses people to go through a perfectly natural thing of forgetting. Does it mean you don't have respect for the person? You don't have regard for the person?
Well, I'm certain that embarrassment over not remembering someone's name could have many, many different sources. It could be related to a person's deep-seated sense of inadequacy or inferiority, or it could be that they don't feel inferior, but they really like the person and they want to impress them, and they may just feel that not recalling the name is going to put them in a bad light. So there could be a variety of reasons that they feel bad about remembering the name. But generally speaking, it is flattering to call someone's name. It feels good when somebody sees you, and we all know that. When somebody sees me and says, "Pierce, how you doing?" It feels good to have your name called. It makes you feel as though you registered on them. You made an impression. You're important enough to them for them to remember your name. Whether they really tried to or not, you'll never know.
But you know, you and I have unusual names, so we don't hear our name very often, our first name, in passing. Whereas other people, if your name is John or Mary or something like that, you never know if it's somebody who remembered you or didn't. So I rarely hear my name mentioned anywhere other than when somebody's addressing me.
And mine always gets mangled. They call me Mr. Pierce or they'll call me Howard, and they've got the order wrong. And I just write it down to this is a person who doesn't focus. They're inattentive. I mean, if they would focus and look at the darn cover of the book, they would see that they got the order
easy
wrong.
Enough. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about different kinds of memory, declarative memory, procedural memory, flashbulb memory, all things that you want to know about. When we come back, my friends, I'll be back with you in a few minutes, a little special music for you and for Pierce Howard.
Sorry, she kicked it out, tell it, 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 tell
from the movie The Inside Man. That's called Chaya Chaya Bollywood Joint. And if you want to remember it, you could write it down. Chaya Chaya Bollywood Joint from the movie The Inside Man, the original motion picture by Sapna Awashtidi. And they're good folks, you know. Nice little bobby piece. 212, no, we're not going to have you call in. This is Armand DeMille. We want to talk with Pierce Howard, and we are talking about memory, and we're talking about some of the different aspects of memory, and we're talking about types of memories. Now, Pierce, you still with us?
Yes, sir.
You like our Indian music?
Absolutely.
Isn't that cute?
Mesmerizing.
You're in North Carolina, aren't you?
Yes, sir.
You got to play that loud on your radio when you're driving around.
Okay.
I don't think it's around there too much. Declarative memory, procedural memory, flashbulb memory. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes. Well, the two major categories of memory are declarative and non-declarative. And it's called declarative memory because it's the kind of memory that you can put into a sentence of some sort, a declarative sentence, such as, I spent last weekend in the mountains, or his name is Armand DeMille. You can put those in sentences, whereas the ability to tie your shoes, you can't say that. You just have to show it.
So that's non-declarative because you can't say it.
You can't say it.
It's really just more a skill.
Exactly. It's a skill. It's a procedure of some kind that you simply do it. You don't say it. Whereas the declarative memories are in two categories. They call them semantic and episodic. And semantic memory is memory for words, like, you know, remembering a name or remembering what a particular word means. Episodic memory is remembering a series of events, an experience of some kind. And what the research suggests is that one can have strengths in one of those three areas, or two of those three areas, or three of those areas, and still be weak in other areas. So we might be strong in all three areas, or I might be stronger in one than the other two, or whatnot. Those are all individual differences. In addition to that, you've got memory for numbers, memory for movements, memory for words, memory for shapes, and those are all different individual differences too. Like, I could have good semantic memory for numbers, but not have good semantic memory for words.
So you can't recall a word, but you could easily recall a number.
I understand what the square root symbol means, and I can easily understand that and recall it. Whereas I might not have as easy a recall of memory for words. So what I'm suggesting here is that people are really different. We're mysterious creatures, and we don't all have the same strengths and weaknesses.
Well, let's ask the audience for a minute, which kind of memory do you think you have and don't have? What's your weak spot? If you think that you have developed a weak spot, is it for names? Is it for things that you used to do? Can you remember riding a bike? Is there a single skill? Sometimes I think, for example, rowing a boat. I rowed a boat most of my youth. You know, I would find a boat and I'd be rowing it. Central Park, I used to love to row the boat. It's a skill. I haven't used it in many, many years. I got back in a boat and there it was. It was still there.
Yes.
But there are other memories, there are other skills that I could imagine forgetting. You know, there are other skills. Oh, I used to know how to do that, but I don't know how to do that. I'd have to get doing it again before I could do it. So that's the one kind of one. That's the skill. Then there are words, names, and numbers. And names and words, I think, are kind of related. Do you forget those, or do you forget numbers? You know, do you forget the number of things? Do you forget the mathematics of things? To me, the strong point in my life has always been mathematics. I could remember things of how to work things out numerically that it still runs through my mind. I didn't even know the Pythagorean theorem. I mean, I have all kinds of formulas sitting in my brain because I was comfortable with them.
Well, you know, really,
I know the square root of pi.
You know, a really interesting thing that affects these memories, too, is stereotypes. Some fascinating research was done with women who were told that women have more trouble with numbers than men do. And they were then given a memory test for numbers, and they performed poorly. Where in comparison to another group of women who basically were told that the research showed that men and women had equal math ability, and those women in that group outperformed the other group dramatically. So it says that, as you said earlier, it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Oh, well, women aren't good with numbers, so I can't remember numbers because I'm a woman. And so part of memory is attitudinal. If you think you have trouble in certain areas, it will increase the likelihood that, in fact, you do have trouble with memory in certain areas. If you've been told by your parents that you have a poor memory for manners, you can't remember your manners, you may start to believe it. But it's not necessarily the case. You may
there
just
are
be
conditions.
Living out a script.
There are conditions, however, there are physical conditions like Alzheimer's, like a number of other things. And I'm familiar with people who are doing research with lung damage, with COPD, and how if you have a reduction in the amount of oxygen that you take in, if your oxygen that you take in is less useful, you can easily destroy brain cells below a certain level. That's why people go on oxygen at certain levels when they have COPD. So there is a thing that does happen. You can start losing memory, and you see people. You see it in the older people who have the disease that takes it away. There are a number of different conditions that do, however, affect memory. And there are things we could do to try to keep it active, but it's very difficult. Some people just lose it. I'm a lucky guy. I have to do research every day for my radio program. I mean, I am exercising my brain, like getting up in the morning and doing brain push-ups at 5 o'clock trying to say, what do we do today? You know? And so I'm lucky because my mind is always being activated in some way. But if you don't use it and you fall into this kind of sloppy retirement world where everything is monochromatic, if a disease does come along, you tend to fall prey to it.
Armand, there was a fascinating study done in Connecticut several decades ago in which a group of doctors, upon retirement, were tested for IQ, and 10 years later they were tested again. And what they were interested in is the relation of mental activity during that 10-year period of retirement. Did they continue to learn in their specialty? Did they continue to practice medicine, maybe as a volunteer, maybe working with Doctors Without Borders or in some other area of neighborhood clinics and being a volunteer there? Or did they basically devote the rest of their life to golf? And what they found is that the doctors who continued to use it outscored the other docs by some 10 IQ points.
That's amazing, isn't it?
It really is use it or lose it. Now, there's another interesting study. Are you familiar with the Nunn study?
Yes, I am. Give the details.
Well, generally speaking, a large group of nuns were studied because of their commonality of lifestyle. It was a very interesting research group. And they were particularly interested in looking at precursors of Alzheimer's and various things related to Alzheimer's. And one of the fascinating things that has come out of that study, and this is one of the more recent findings, because they had to wait for some people to die before they could go in and look at their brains. What they found is that, first of all, they found that when these women were alive, these nuns were alive, that the women who continued to use their minds, they learned new skills. They learned new languages. They learned new sports. They learned new gardening techniques. They learned, just in other words, they had a thirst for learning, and they enjoyed using language. These nuns had a dramatically lower rate, like 60%, 70% lower rate of Alzheimer's than the nuns who basically rested on their accomplishments and said, I know enough, let me just share what I know, and I don't need to continue learning. Now, that was the first learning that was so interesting. But the one that's even more interesting than that is that when the nuns who continued learning and did not get Alzheimer's, when they died and their brains were dissected, the researchers found an extremely high number of them were in stage 3 and stage 4 Alzheimer's. But behaviorally, they had not exhibited the normal characteristics of stage 3 and stage 4 Alzheimer's. In other words, the continuing habit of using their minds defied the advance of plaques and tangles in their brain.
Yeah. I wonder how the brain's weighed. You know, it's interesting. The more active a brain is, the more it weighs. And the less active it is, the less weight. You could actually, we used to measure
it's
the
density.
Weight of brains.
It's actual density. Every time you learn something, you add a new synapse. And
that's like
new,
muscles.
New branches, yeah. And so every time you learn, you're adding synapses, and that increases the density, therefore the weight.
But getting smart does make you gain weight, therefore. it's all in my brain. This is Armand DeMille with Dr. Pierce Howard. So nuns got into a new habit.
There you go.
Habit of learning. So here's the thing. I mean, doesn't it make sense if you love your parents and your parents retire, would you get them the latest computer, please, and then sit down with them and teach them about the Internet and show them how they could kind of go across the world and back and learn anything they ever wanted to learn? Wouldn't it be wonderful if you could introduce them to the joy of it?
Well, in fact, I'll suggest a good model for doing that. My oldest sister will be 90 in December. She lives in Pittsburgh, and she has continued to use her mind in an amazing way. And just a year ago, she was given by her children, at her request, a computer. And being completely awed by this thing, she needed help. So she found in her church, she found a high school boy that would come by once or twice a week after school and help her with things like learning to surf the Internet, learning to do email, learning to print, learning to attach documents. And over the last year, she's become rather sophisticated in using that computer. And I now correspond with her by email when I couldn't do it a year ago. We're going to celebrate her 90th birthday in Pittsburgh in about a month. I'm really looking forward to that.
And what's her name?
Virginia McGahey.
Hey, so happy birthday, Virginia McGahey. And now that she knows how to use a computer, she can go to our website, thepositivemind.com, and she can get a replay of today's program, and she can hear us wishing her happy birthday. And that's the magic. You know, it's kind of interesting that as we've gotten into this newest age, that everything is about memory, that the cameras are about memory, computers are about memory, that we've externalized memory to increase the power of our thinking, you know? So it's kind of getting out there, and it's available for us.
Well,
and
you know, it's interesting. One of the things that we've not talked about is this, the whole idea of photographic memory or eidetic memory. And it's very problematic. There are two different camps with respect to this. There are the scholars who say there is no such thing, and there are other scholars who say, well, yes, maybe there is such a thing. From the way I read the research, I tend to hold with those who say there is no such thing. It's an illusion. Memories are stored in pieces. If you remember somebody's face, you don't store the face as a photograph. You store it as little pieces of curves and straight lines and colors and textures and into hundreds or thousands of different elements. And then when you try to recall that face, you're actually not recalling the entire picture. You're reconstructing it piece by piece. And sometimes you get it right and sometimes you get it wrong. And we normally have little flaws in memory because we don't always get all the pieces exactly right. But when we do get it right, it's likely because we have used that memory a lot, and we have we have established a neural network that, because of practice, the nerve fibers have gotten thicker and they're transmitting more effectively. There was a, if you remember the Watergate hearings, John Dean's testimony.
What do you mean, if I remember? Oh, of course, there are people who never heard.
Yeah. Well, the one of the things that characterized the Watergate hearings was testimony by John Dean, and people were just blown out by his photographic memory. He just had all of this detail that he provided in his testimony. But later, when records were found that could corroborate his testimony, they found that most of his testimony was at best flawed and at worst made up.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of things will affect your memory. They found about depression and memory that memory recall tends to be congruent with the mood. Depressed people are more likely to recall negative events and not have as much of a memory of things that are not negative events. So that's the study of Hertel in 2004. In addition, depression is often associated with poor memory in general. In general, you know, so, I mean, it just makes sense. If you're depressed, you're slower brained, you know, and your brain is slower and there's less activity and there's less stuff laying it down. Also, there's emotionally induced forgetting, which is the kind of retrograde amnesia you get for events that are very powerful in your life. You know, you could forget it. You could forget a beating. There are different kinds of amnesia. We got a minute. Shall we go over the retrograde amnesia? You could do that, Pierce.
There really are, generally speaking, about four different kinds of amnesia. You've got anterograde amnesia, in which you tend to have less ability to recall events after an injury. That was the case with your Central Park jogger rape case. The memory for after the critical event was decreased. Retrograde amnesia goes in the opposite direction. It's inability to remember events preceding a particular brain injury. The third one is psychogenic amnesia.
But before we go to the third, the first two seem to service mankind so well, or animals so well, because to forget the pain, and I know the chemicals work this way, if you go through surgery, you know, and if you go through surgery, you'll very often forget having gone through surgery, even if they give you just a local. You don't remember the thing because you amnesia. You somehow lay it down. You forget about it. You know, so it kind of serves you. It serves you if you're going to be in pain to be able to have either of those two amnesia. Amnesia works for you to be able to forget something so that you don't go through the emotional conflict of it and over again.
In fact, with the discovery of new drugs.
Birth is a big one, isn't it?
Yes. Well, you know, with the discovery of new drugs to improve memory, there is a caution. I mean, are we really sure that we want to improve our memory so much that we can't forget things that we want to forget? I mean, there's a price to pay for dramatically improved memory. I mean, some things we just better enjoy that we can't remember.
Part of the work with post-traumatic stress disorder is helping people forget. You know, the newest approach is to help people forget the trauma they went through.
Yes, and...
Now, the other two are the psychogenic and the source, and we've got about 2 minutes, so I'm not going to introduce you. I'm not going to interrupt you.
Okay, well, the psychogenic is simply amnesia that's fragmentary. Some kind of traumatic event interferes with storage, and it's kind of erratic. It's different from the first two in the sense that it's more fragmentary, no particular pattern. And source amnesia is the most interesting one. In the sense that you can't remember where you learned something in the first place. You know, did I get it from my mama or from a girlfriend or from a sister? Where did I get that memory from? And it's like a stranger to you. You've got the memory, but you just can't remember where you got it from.
Where you got it from. It's fascinating. Of course, we could continue for days doing this. We may have to come back and revisit it. My guest is Dr. Pierce Howard. Pierce first name, Howard second name. And the Owner's Manual for the Brain, which he's been very generous. We want to thank you at WBAI for your generous offer on the books that you sent us for the marathon.
Well, thank you. And I would mention to readers, listeners who may be familiar with the book from the past, that this is third edition, which just came out in April. It's over 1,000 pages. There's a lot of new material in there in comparison to the earlier edition.
Great. And thank you for calling in. And if you wanted a copy of today's program, you would get it from by going to thepositivemind.com. You could hear it like that. And I, my friends, will be back with you on Tuesday when we have a special guest who's going to be talking about the heart in an unusual way. So we'll be back with you on Tuesday at 1 p.m., and then Thursday we have more exciting programming going on. It's just remarkable here. Be sure to join us. History has been that stage, the miniskirts.